gurus start now. My name is Kevin O'Brien, and Brian Nas and I are going to be talking this week about what we're calling the ethics of energy. And that's a way of framing what we're going to do as an environmental ethics class. And because I hate surprises, I want to go ahead and tell you what we think is the point of all five lectures. I used to try and find my Christmas presents desperately before Christmas because surprise is no fun. The first thing that we think we're going to get to say is that environmental issues are incredibly complex. Understanding them is really hard to do. Figuring out what we should do about them is even harder to do. The second thing that we want to say is it helps us to engage, to address this complexity, if we understand environmental issues as issues of energy. That energy is a way to talk about environmental issues. And energy in particular, one of the reasons we're really interested in it, is a way we think that a scientist like Brian can talk with a humanist, a theologian, a Christian ethicist like me about environmental issues, that energy is a common language we can learn to share. And then the third thing that we plan to say is that Christian communities, in particular, should use energy as a scientific, an ethical, and a theological concept when we think about what we should be doing to care for God's creation. Those are the three points that we think we're going to make. But of course, the reason we got into this was so we could have a discussion with each other and with you all. And so if other conclusions end up coming out, we'll be thrilled about that. So don't hold me to that. That's just for truth and advertising. That's what we think right now. So I have to give credit. One of the reasons I wanted to talk first was so I could give Brian full credit for sort of hatching this idea. It was 2 years ago when I started work at PLU, where Brian and I both teach, that Brian sort of pinned me down over lunch one day and said, we should be talking about energy. And 2 years of conversations have led to this class, and hopefully will lead to more conversations. The reason I want to give Brian lots of credit for that is 2 years ago, gas was $2.50 a gallon, and energy wasn't on most people's radar. It was not a big topic of discussion. And so for Brian to say we really need to be talking about energy shows that he was aware of things going on that most of us weren't as aware of. 2 years ago, there was still pretty lively public debate over whether global climate change was real. And for Brian to say, as he did then, and as he's going to say today, we need to talk about something bigger than climate change. We need to talk about energy, of which climate change is just one small part, was bold, was insightful. And so I'm just excited to be part of this conversation with Brian. Giving him full credit, of course, is also giving him full blame if it goes bad. But like I said, we think so far, and we're going to try it with you, that energy is a way to have a conversation. It's a language that we can talk about both science and ethics, and we can talk about how science and ethics are both theological. In particular, we're going to talk today to introduce divine energy about natural energy and social energy. And so you hear there's a scientific concept, natural energy, and an ethical concept, social energy. If you've been around environmental issues at all, then you won't be surprised to hear we're not going to leave it as you've got your natural scientific issues over here and your ethical social issues over here. We're going to say that the natural and the social are interconnected, interrelate, and intermingle. And so we're going to say social energy has to pay attention to natural energy, and natural energy has to pay attention to social energy. Science and religion should be in dialogue. And we're not going to talk too much about how this is a science-religion dialogue, but we want to make it clear that it is a science-religion dialogue. If you get really into that piece, I think Larry on Friday will be talking about creationism and how to talk to creationists. That's another really important science-religion dialogue. What we're trying to do is something a little different, which is how to use energy to have science and religion talk to each other. Since most of today and really most of the week is to define energy, I want to spend maybe 3 minutes defining ethics. Brian was really bold in saying that he doesn't want it to be a chemist and an ethicist talking. He wants me to have to figure out how to talk chemistry. and he wants to figure out how to talk ethics. And he already does it, at least as well as I do. But it's a brave thing to do because ethics is something that makes lots of people nervous. A story I tell a lot is that once I was on an airplane, and the very chatty woman next to me asked me what I did for a living. And I said, I teach Christian ethics. And she looked away quickly and didn't say anything for about 5 minutes. And that was awkward. And finally, she turned to me and she said, well, I have to apologize to you because yesterday I took the Lord's name in vain. And I don't remember what I said. I stuttered. I said, well, that's okay. Or maybe if I was feeling cheeky, I said, Jesus, lady, I don't care. But what I should have pointed out is that she was making two assumptions about ethics that I don't think are true, that are about what ethics isn't. One thing she was assuming was that because I'm an ethicist, I'm all about judging other people. That my job is to figure out when people are doing something wrong and call them out on it. And that is absolutely not the job of an ethicist. That's not what Brian and I are trying to do when we do our ethics event. The other thing that she was assuming was that because I was an ethicist, I knew what the right thing to do was and the wrong thing to do was. I knew for a fact whether or not it's ever okay to take the Lord's name in vain. That's not ethics as I understand it, that's not ethics as we're trying to do it. We see ethics as a way to have a conversation. The hard work of figuring out what's really wrong, what's really right, what's really good, what's really bad, is way too important to leave to ethicists. That's work that we have to do in communities, having discussions. And so we're really committed to doing this ethics of energy as a discussion, and we are not going to give you answers about this is the way, the truth, and the light of what we should be doing to live as part of God's creation, to use energy in this world. Rather, we're going to be trying to offer some tools to have a conversation, to have an open discussion, and to be able to listen to each other, even when we disagree, especially when we disagree. Since I don't think I've quite used my 3 minutes, I will tell you, one of the ways I get this across to my students when I teach Christian ethics is that I say, ethics as we're going to do it is the opposite of a bumper sticker. Because what a bumper sticker does is a bumper sticker throws out, this is what I believe in 4 words or less, and a bumper sticker seems to assume there's lots of clarity about what the truth is. My Body, My Choice is a bumper sticker that says, this is where I stand, and if you disagree with me, I don't really care, because I've got it all laid out right here. It's a Child, Not a Choice does the exact same thing. Neither one invites discussion. A bumper sticker is essentially a way to shout out your opinion and not be able to hear anybody else's. There's space for bumper stickers in the world, but that's not ethics. I have to put in a plug for a book I haven't written. I hope to someday on this subject, which will be called The Ethics of Bumper Stickers, : Talking Out of Our Rear Ends. Look for that in your local bookstore in 2020 or so. So ethics as we're doing it is not a bumper sticker. We're not going to tell you this is the ethics of energy. What we're going to do is we're going to ask some questions, and we're going to throw out some language to use to have a discussion. And we want to invite you into that discussion. We want to invite you to contribute what you have to that discussion, and also to do what we're doing when we talk to each other, which is step out of what you know really well and try on something else. I don't know much chemistry at all, but I know a lot more since I've been talking to Brian. And I hope you've learned a little ethics. And that's worked because we both really tried to learn each other's language and tried to have a discussion, which is what we're up to for these 5 days and for today when we lay out this sort of Ethics of Energy 101. The way to start that, as I say, is to listen outside our comfort zone. Often when I give this lecture, I then talk for another 40 minutes, which doesn't make any sense. Today, I have the privilege of actually getting to listen because Brian is going to start us out with some tools to think about both energy from a natural scientific perspective and an ethics of energy. So, Brian's turn.
So my job is, as Kevin said, is to spend 10-15 minutes telling you a natural science view of energy. And so I started thinking about how I could do that and spend a little time talking about the science. But more importantly, maybe give you an insight about how I think about the scientific world of energy. And so I was kind of struggling for a place to start. And I realized that I needed to start with an insight that I had about 3 or 4 years ago. This insight came out of many conversations I had with a semi-retired pastor in the congregation that I belong to. Some of you are here. So I know at least 10 people in this room know Richard Hermstedt. He's a friend of mine who I have had many deep conversations with. Richard was originally a linguist, studied English. He's about words. And he's the one who taught me that words really do matter. It doesn't matter whether you're a scientist or a poet. The words that you use to describe something create a framework that changes your options to teach. It changes your options to think. It actually shapes the way you think about a problem. And it has vast implications if you start thinking about the entry of ethics and energy into the policy arena. And so the example that I came up with in these conversations with Richard was relatively simple. It was this insight. I, at the time, I was really kind of struggling with trying to figure out, how to place fundamentalist Christianity in my worldview. So this is the start of my energy talk. And what I realized was that the thing that bothered me the most about some of the political dialogue was their use of the word liberal. They had sort of fought a battle to label folks, honestly, like me, as liberal. And so what I started doing is that any time I was around a fundamentalist friend or engaged in debate, I would go out of my way to say, I really have a hard time understanding your liberal religion. And I truly believe that. I mean, if you look at that piece of theology, the theology of the American fundamentalist movement is 100, 150 years old. This is new stuff. This is a liberal reinterpretation of what I view as a much more orthodox mainstream Protestant thought stream. And so now, people, at least in my small domain, are used to me hearing that. And even my fundamentalist friends grudgingly admit, okay, yeah, maybe there's some thoughts there. But it's a frame, right? I have tried, in that case, to step out of this liberal frame and say, I really think this is an important word, let's redefine it. So many of you, I'm sure, have read George Lakoff's book. He had two books. Moral Politics was this kind of big book about framing. It was too hard for me. Smaller book was Don't Think of an Elephant, Know Your Values and Frame the Debate, which is a wonderful structure to think about this kind of framing. If you're not familiar with Lakoff's argument, I would recommend Don't Think of an Elephant. So the frame. Moving a little bit closer to the energy perspective, frames are important in the way we teach, the way we think, the way we view policy. A few examples. How many of you remember the Clean Skies Initiative? Some of you do. Clean Skies Initiative was a Bush administration plan to dump untold more amounts of mercury into our air, a change in that. The way we regulate the emissions from coal-fired power plants. They knew the importance of the frame. We're going to frame this as the Clean Skies Act. Another one of my personal favorites, the Clean Coal Program, wasn't Bush Reagan's government. I'll talk a little bit about coal in a few minutes, but a clean coal, in my opinion, is an oxymoron. It's a frame. It's a phrase that's been repeated over and over and over again for 25 years. Not directly on the environmental front, but I think important, because I believe that education is an important part of any sort of environmental work. One of my favorite frames is No Child Left Behind. It's another frame. And so we need to really think about the frames that we use as we talk about energy. Now, I will point out that there is a downside. This framing thing really amounts to a little bit of kind of small manipulation. So those of you who know me, know my wife Corey, will know that probably not be surprised when now she has adopted the language. She said, "That's a frame, isn't it?" as I'm trying to just sort of manipulate the situation. That's an interesting frame. And when people recognize your frame, it's over. Doesn't work. All right, so what in the world does this all have to do with energy? I'll get to that in a couple minutes. I still got a few more minutes to get to energy. There's another perspective that I want to go that I think helps with this, with what we're trying to do with the notion of energy. This is another one from PLU. At PLU, we have what we call first-year experience for the freshmen. It's a lot of things that allow the freshmen to kind of interact, different sorts of opportunities for them to interact with faculty, each other. But one of the parts of our PLU first year experience is called the Explore Weekend. So this is a lot of the freshman class go on this, a lot of the faculty members go on it, and we have this short like day and a half retreat at a place near PLU off campus, where faculty members and staff sit in groups, large group discussions followed by small group discussions. So it's like 10, 12 students, a couple faculty members. Wonderful time. But the theme for the last couple of years in this Explore Weekend has been looking for big enough questions. In the PLU context is, what are the big enough questions for you to spend 4 years thinking about? You know, take the time that you have here in college to ask big enough questions. So here is our first frame. Global warming is not a big enough question. We have, Lord knows it's a problem. Neither of us are naysayers. Important problem that needs all of our attention. But if we focus all of our energy on global warming, it's not a big enough question. Let me give you an example. From my lens, anyway, when I listen to the debate that goes on in public as people talk about global warming, we're at a place now where I don't think there's a whole lot of debate about whether climate change is real or not. The debate tends to be always about a carbon footprint. Not only is it about a carbon footprint, it's about a carbon point source, right? We are at the point of Honda's launching a hydrogen vehicle last week. Honda FCX, hydrogen fuel cell vehicle. Wonderful. A lot of the press associated with this, what a wonderful, wonderful opportunity to slow global warming. All of the debate, most, not all, but a lot of the debate around that is focused on the point that the hydrogen that we use in the fuel cell has byproducts of water. So there's water coming out of the tailpipe. Wonderful. The obvious question for those of us who have thought about this a little bit is, where does the hydrogen come from? Turns out that for the foreseeable future, the hydrogen comes from natural gas. And guess what happens when we make hydrogen from natural gas? We've got hydrogen. We've got carbon monoxide or carbon dioxide left over. So by focusing our climate change energies on, in this case, point source carbon footprint, we're not asking a big enough question. And so what we suggest here is, let's step back, take a slightly bigger look, a bigger question. And I think energy, in the natural science sense, I'm gonna do this in 3 or 4 minutes, maybe 4. So, energy. What's energy? My apologies to folks that I've been around for a week. I've done this once before. Energy takes many forms. So the first one great example is
kinetic.
What?
Kinetic.
So, all right. So, but what? When we define energy, by the way, I picked this up. It's a medical dictionary. Yeah, just a little family argument. How do we expend energy in the world? Beth?
How do we expend energy?
Yeah, what's energy?
To do work.
Doing work, right. The graph of that, too bad. All right, so I'm doing work, and so energy is doing work. Where does the energy come from to do this work? Pardon?
Gravity
is what makes it happen, but where does the energy come from to do this work?
Picking it up. Oh, lifting it up.
Yeah, well, that's not the prime source. That's not a big enough question.
Sun's
probably the best answer. The intermediate answer would be breakfast. Right? And so we have, this is a small example, but energy is this, and the word I like, it's a fungible thing. Changing. Now in this case, I'm changing oatmeal to book lifting. We use the sun's energy and some water to grow the oats. There's a whole flow, in this case, of what we consider the sort of natural energy. It's the way we use it is changeable, fungible. And so many of you who have heard me talk before will know my food, water, air, energy diagram. These are energy uses. We choose to use some energy for clean water. We don't choose to do much there, actually. We choose to use a lot of our energy to make food. We choose to modify the quality of our air because of the types of energy we use. These are energy uses. They're interrelated. Quick example, some of you heard on Saturday. India, about 15% of the food that India produces is food that's made from groundwater mining, non-replenishable groundwater supplies. It'll run out sometime. So we've got a lot of food that is in danger because we're running out of water. 15% of the population of India, about 175 million people, food to feed 175 million people. As the water table drops and drops, they have to drill deeper and deeper, use more and more energy to pump the water up. That energy comes from coal-fired power plants. So you know there is a little energy use scenario that I think works. We spend a significant amount of our energy uses, food, water, air. What I want you to take away from here is that if when I think of energy use, I see no difference between food and water. We need water to make food. No food, no water, no food. Right? We need to think flexibly about what these things are. By the way, this is leftover energy. We use most energy in our car, at least around Seattle. Okay. So cars, homes, and food are the biggest thing. I'm running slow. So these are energy uses. The next question, perhaps the start of the big enough question, is where does energy come from? So we have some graphs. And on these graphs,
there's not enough.
Yeah, you're going to have to share. There's 25 of these. These are not things that are frameable
I'll make some more copies for it too.
Okay. But on this graph, you see energy sources. It's not probably critical that you see these. What this is a graph of where our energy in the U.S. comes from by year. So We, if you look back to 1850, you see most of our energy is coming from wood. If you look around 1900, most of our energy is coming from coal. If you look at the advent of the petroleum era, you see petroleum and natural gas, which are typically found together, they come on around 1950. You see lines in there for hydropower and nuclear power. So to honor time, I'm gonna make this really kind of short and hopefully pointed. These are the feed streams that are coming into our energy to do work. They're fungible. We can change one to another. Before natural gas was discovered, many homes and many streetlights in cities were powered by something called water gas. This was this is something that's carbon monoxide, hydrogen formed by running steam over coke, which is what's left over after you take the distillable thing out of coal. So we can run lights off of coal. Coal, by the way, is something that this whole C1 chain, coal, natural gas, things that are just pieces of carbon, we can make those into gasoline. It's not hard. South Africa has been making methane or natural gas into synthetic gasoline ever since the mid-70s. I was talking with Pastor Story earlier today about that, asking him what he thought of this process, and he said, I've done some work in that city, and it doesn't smell good. Which I believe. All right, so where I'm going here are two points that I want you to think about. The energy, the way we choose to use energy, is interchangeable. The energy that we have coming in is mostly interchangeable. If we look at one kind of theme in here, it's wood, coal, petroleum, natural gas. These are all carbon fuels. What's the next one going to be? It's a question that we'll talk about. But you know, the debate now that we need to talk about is biofuels. Biofuels is the same, is another thing that we can throw into this hopper. Just as we can take methane and turn it into gasoline, we can take biofuels and turn it into gasoline. These are all, from a energetic perspective, they're interchangeable. Right? Some efficiencies, better or worse, but they're interchangeable. The other line that I would argue is that exists here is it is the hydropower, nuclear power line. These are ways of making electricity. Now, electricity is a slightly different thing. It's not super easy to make chemicals out of electricity, too, if you wanted to. But it's something that we use, and it's one of the energy pieces that goes in here. What's the next electricity source that we have? How big is that nuclear line going to get? Let me just stipulate that both Kevin and I think geothermal, solar, wind, these are wonderful things. They're going to be an important part of the future. These are not large ethical debates. They're technical debates, you know, in my opinion. I would say that we fund them as much as we can. We hope the research works. We reap the benefits of these truly renewable resources. But a more interesting question, I think, is what's going to happen here in the next 50 years? And so what I've tried to do here is just kind of frame that energy is a big thing that we can use as a way of, as a lens to look at a variety of materials that we take into a variety of uses. We make choices about the inputs into that stream. We make choices about the outputs of that stream. And there is a constraint. And if we run out of water, we run out of food. If we run out of one of the feed streams, we have to decide we're going to use less or use one of the others. All of these things have consequences that are not only scientific, they have some social consequences.
Why don't I talk about this?
Okay.
So I take you back to my story. Brian took me out to lunch and said, we should talk about energy. And he told me a lot about petroleum and natural gas, and he told me that the gumbo I was eating at that moment was becoming energy, and I could do work with it, and that energy was fungible. And I thought it was all really interesting, and I sort of said, but I'm not sure that has anything to do with Christian ethics. And so I had to go home and think for a while. I had to find a way to make this theological. A really cheap and easy way to make something theological is to find some quotes from the Bible and then come up with three categories. So guess what I'm going to do now. So, does theology have anything to do with energy? Well, I was thinking about that and happened to go to church and held hands with the people next to me and said, "For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, now and forever." And I thought, well, what do we mean by power? That's energy. We talk in the Christian tradition about the power of God. I want to kind of focus a little. We talk about the creative power of God. Right in the beginning of Genesis, chapter 1, we hear about God creating a wind over the waters and then dividing land from sea. And that's energy. That's God's creative power. We move from that, I'm going really quickly here, to Genesis 2. And God has created all manner of things, and then we get to a different creation story, and God creates human beings and puts us in a garden and says that our responsibility is to till and keep it. Now, in Christian environmental ethics, we talk about that in stewardship language. That God's command there is that human beings are to be stewards of the earth. Another way to say that would be, God has used God's creative energy to make this earth and to make people on it. And God instructs us to use our energy to take care of this earth, to till and keep it. That's the creative power of God and how it calls us for stewardship. This fundamental Christian belief, by the way, that God created the world is one of the ways that Brian and I finally came up with that our talk fits into the theme of Holy Summer, the foolishness of God. Because both of us begin to contemplate that God creating a world which would develop over geologic time, have all this fossil fuel energy stored under the ground, and then God creating human beings with free will who could find it and do what we've done with it, seems foolish to us. We don't get it. And that's something I ponder. But what I can say as an environmental ethicist, and we can obviously talk lots more about this over lunch or some other time, is I think the Christian tradition has a strong message that we are responsible to be stewards of God's creation, of what God has made with God's creative energy. Type of energy one. Guess how many there's going to be. Number two, God grants, we hear lots of stories in our tradition about God granting power to people to do miraculous things. So in Exodus, Moses is told, "Go show Pharaoh the wondrous powers God has granted." In the New Testament, we read lots of stories about Jesus using power to heal, to do mighty works. There's one of my favorite, sort of most confusing stories, the woman who reaches out and touches Jesus' hem and is healed. And Jesus looks around, in the Gospel of Luke version anyway, and says, "I felt power go out of me." And so there's this power from God to do miracles. I'm not going to talk too much more about that because hoping for a miracle I don't think is a good energy policy. So quickly, to type three. I think in our Christian tradition, one of the most important ways we talk about energy, we talk about power, is the power to act as human beings, the power to act in communities and as communities, and the power to change communities. I think that the most energetic part of the Trinity, this is where we get our preference for threes, by the way, the most energetic aspect of the Trinity is the Holy Spirit. Pneumatology is all about energy. It's about the Holy Spirit. It comes, of course, from the same root as the word pneumatological drill. It's about air. The Spirit is the energy of God. And, of course, the Spirit's moment to shine in the Bible is in Acts, at Pentecost. And you remember what happens in Pentecost, at the Pentecost? There's a mighty wind, and then tongues of flame, that's energy, appear over the heads of the followers of Jesus. And that gives them the power to communicate in many languages and inspires them to go out and spread the good news, to spread the gospel. This is the kind of energy I want to talk about as a theological concept, as a concept of Christian ethics. The energy to form communities, the energy to change communities, and the energy to act, to do something. That's what I want to talk about as social energy. One last biblical quote so you'll really believe I'm theological. Colossians chapter 1, 29. The author is talking about this work of spreading the gospel and writes, "For the gospel, I toil and struggle with all the energy that God powerfully inspires in me." And that right there is what turned me on, what said, okay, we can do this. Christian ethics has something to say about energy. The first thing Christian ethics has to say about energy is that it comes from God. The energy buried in the ground as coal comes from God. The energy we use to drop books, to talk to each other, to get up to Holden, to make lunch, to eat lunch, comes from God. The energy we use to be in communities, to act as communities, to change communities, comes from God. And that's the type of energy I want to talk about as social energy. Social energy is, if it's energy, Brian's given us a definition of energy, it's the capacity to do work that's fungible, that you can change. Social energy is the capacity to do work within and upon human systems, upon society. That's social energy. It's the capacity, as I've said now 8 or so times, to form a community, to act as a community, to change a community. Notice there's 3 of those. It's also fungible. We can use our energy in lots of different ways. We have energy and we can choose to use it. I can devote my energy to poring over the internet for the latest rumor about how, who are the ones who are about to break up? Madonna and Guy Ritchie are doing. That's a use of my energy. Or I can use that energy in a different way. I can use that energy to try and get people to get away from their computer screens and actually talk to each other and talk about what would make a better world. Those are both uses of energy. My energy is fungible. I have choices to make about how to use it. And that's how I think it's helpful to think about social energy in the context of natural energy. I want to briefly return to one of Brian's themes, which is that language matters. Because sometimes when I think about this, I think, okay, so I've got this idea about social energy, but that's just a couple words. Who cares? But again, as Brian said, I want to say language matters. Language matters because language is one of our primary tools for changing communities, for joining communities, for acting in communities. Language is, in some sense, the currency of social energy. Language is how society works. So this is just words, but it's words that matter. And I think if we understand social energy in this way, we have a better way to think about how do we want to talk about global climate change? And how is talking about global climate change different from talking about paper versus plastic? How are we using our energy if what we're thinking about is what am I going to get when I go to the grocery store versus what do I drive and what does it contribute to the air versus what fundamentally are we as a species doing with the energy God has given us? That language matters. A really quick example of how this language matters occurred to me when I was at orientation here. And usually when I'm at home, I'm not always a good environmental ethicist. When I think about where my electricity comes from, I think it comes from the outlets in the wall. And beyond that, I'm not all that concerned. At orientation, they showed us a video and made it very clear to us that electricity in Holden Village comes from the river. Electricity in Holden Village comes from water. That language switch really matters because that gets us to pay attention. This water matters. This being a healthy water flow matters. How much snow there is melting matters. It would be equally true to say that Holden Village gets its electricity from a turbine and shed, or Holden Village gets its electricity from gravity. Those things are true, but that language isn't very helpful because I don't need to look after the turbine and the shed, and none of us are really going to have too much effect on gravity as far as I can figure. But we do all need to think about water and think about weather insofar as water matters. So language matters, and language changes how we think about energy. One last language matters. Some of you hearing what I'm talking about as social energy might be thinking, I've heard this before, we called it social capital. And in lots of ways, social capital is the same idea. Social capital is the ability to affect change in human systems. The reason I like social energy better than social capital is social energy is a bigger idea, I think. It's more encompassing. The other reason I don't like social capital is an economic phrase. And that's important. We're going to talk a little tomorrow about how important it is we talk about economics. But the economics just be one part of the discussion. And when we talk about capital, when I talk about capital, I tend to start thinking about dollars and nothing else. And I think energy is a way to talk about more. Social energy, in other words, is a way to ask a bigger question than social capital. So that's why I think that language matters. Again, if you disagree with me, I really want to talk about it. So the point is, if we believe that theological language matters, and if we believe that the energy in this world, in our communities, is created by God, then it tells us that the way we're using energy has impacts. It tells us that we as Christians, those of us who are Christians, have a responsibility to be good stewards, not only of the energy that is buried under the ground, but also of the energy we have and the energy we participate in as communities. We're supposed to be stewards not just of the earth out there, the energy out there, but also us right here, and the energy we have as individuals and as a community. The other thing that that helps me say, and Brian already planted the seeds for this, is if you have one of these in front of you, look back at that graph. This graph is about the past. Since it ends in 2000, it's only about the past. It's not even about the present. It's tempting to say, so this is the way it is. And you see, we use a lot of petroleum, we use a fair amount of natural gas, we use pretty big amount of coal, a little bit of nuclear power, a little bit of hydroelectric, not much wood. What's really crucial to recognize is that those were choices society made. Those are choices societies made. Those are choices people made. People decided. Petroleum is a really good way to fuel our lives together. People decided. Wood isn't as helpful. Let's not use it so much. People decided coal is a great way to make a whole lot of change happen fast, but when we can access the petroleum, let's use coal a little bit less. Those are decisions people made. And if those are decisions people made, they took social energy to make and to enact. And if social energy could make these choices, social energy can make other choices in the future. And the reason I stress this is because it's really tempting, certainly for me, to say, well, I wonder what the next energy source is going to be. I wonder what they're going to do. And of course, it's not they. It's we. It's, I wonder what we're going to do. And I don't get to just sit back and wonder. I have to feel some responsibility, some agency, some power to change what it is we're going to do. What sources of energy do I want us to use? And how am I going to make that happen? How am I going to use what social energy I have to get more people on the bandwagon with my social energy, to get us to use energy responsibly, to get us to be good stewards? So social energy shapes natural energy, shapes how we use our natural energy. The reverse is also true, and I'll do this really quickly. The choices we've made about natural energy have shaped our society. And that's, I don't think, a controversial point to make. Petroleum has shaped our nation. We have ribbons of asphalt, which Brian assured me today is made out of? Yes, we make asphalt out of oil. And we covered our nation in it so that we could put oil in cars and drive around our nation. And we built suburbs because it was pretty easy to put fuel in our cars and get to work or wherever else we wanted to go from our homes. Petroleum shaped our society. And it can be tempting to say, so that's the society we live in. We live in a petroleum society. But no, choices were made. Petroleum doesn't just shape our society. Our society shapes the way our society uses petroleum. So we have a responsibility. The same is true of coal. We have choices to make about whether we want to do more mountaintop mining in particularly the southeast of this country. We have choices to make about what it's worth when we see a disaster in a coal mine in West Virginia, about what those lives are worth. Those are choices our society is making. Right now our society is saying, it's worth losing some coal miners every year, if we get coal to run our power plants and pollute our air, that's choices we're making. That's social energy being expended. And we need to be deliberate about that. So if social energy and natural energy influence each other, if these two things are interrelated, then if we want to change our social structures, we have to change our energy structures. And if we want to change our energy structures, we have to change our social structures. One energy is going to require the other kind of energy. That's, again, maybe foolishly, the way God built the world. So the question that we're going to get to in a minute, after Brian has a chance to rebut and correct what I've said, is how has God given us the power to make the changes we need to make? And then we'll talk for the rest of the week about what those changes might be. But let me give Brian a chance to step in before we throw it over.
Okay, so where I think we need to go from here is do a little bit more of a commercial about the rest of the week. Put it in a frame, and then we'll go back to the question. So, remember frame one that we're offering here is that we need to talk about energy because global warming is not a big enough question. What we've done here is basically said that we're gonna stipulate solar's good, wind's good, geothermal's good, and probably, quite frankly, less interesting to debate and talk about. And so what we're going to do for the rest of the week is focus on what does the future of these energy curves that you have look like? What's out there? So tomorrow we're going to talk about hydrogen. Now, hydrogen is a amazing way of storing energy with vast implications both on the natural science and social notions of energy. On Wednesday we're going to talk about biofuels, the food for fuels debate, and on Thursday have a very casual discussion about nuclear power. And then on Friday we're going to try and sum it up and come back. So that's where we're at for the week. But what we'd like to do with the roughly 10, 12 minutes that we have left is ask this question, and let's talk. The question that you have before you is: are our churches asking big enough questions about natural and social energy? Let's talk. And you know, some of you know me, and you'll realize that if I'm comfortable with silence. Kevin and I both teach freshmen. And so we'll let silence go for 15 to 20 seconds, and then we'll start embarrassing people. So let's talk.
I don't have an answer to the question. The question that question makes me think of is, what questions are our churches even asking about natural and social energy? So I'm not sure where to begin as far as addressing the bigness of them, because I don't know if I've heard the questions.
Do you have an idea? I mean, do you belong to a church community?
Yes.
Okay, so what is your church community?
I belong to a church community that has a very large, very old building that pays $10,000 in winter months for its gas bill. Mm-hmm. And did finally stop putting out styrofoam recently in favor of drinkware that is... So I suppose there are a few questions about energy use that are being asked, but they are very small ones in that case. So, I mean, my answer would be no, but I'm curious if there are other questions being asked other places that we're not asking.
I think one of the reasons why churches are not asking these questions as pointedly as you would like is because people perceive that the answers are in the technical details. So when you say that we can throw biofuels at a problem, or that when we generate hydrogen now from natural gas, we are adding to the greenhouse gas problem, churches, of course, are not going to be able to get involved in these kinds of technical discussions. And so I'm asking you, why are you asking us? I'm being serious. I happen to work in biofuels, actually, one problem. I'm not going to be here for the rest of the week, so I was just wondering where these guys were going. Why is it, for example, that we can throw biofuels at it and biofuels will not act as a significant solution to the energy problems of tomorrow. I mean, if you could tell me that, I can go back to the University of Minnesota and stop the nonsense that I'm engaged in.
I really don't want to have, I think biofuels is a wonderful opportunity if it's developed appropriately. And it's probably going to have time to do it here, but we'll do it on Wednesday. So I'm not negative about biofuels. I think it's something that needs to be discussed and managed. The question I would have, what I think I heard, was that the technical community that needs to sort of inform the church community what the right answer is. Maybe that's a misquote, but my view of the church is it's a community. Every church I've ever been involved with has scientists inside of it. And I think it's the conversations that occur inside the community are true learning experience.
Now, I'm not suggesting, I'm not trying to be either contentious, nor am I trying to suggest that the scientists, whoever they may be, should be telling the churches how to think. But I'm asking you that if the solutions are going to be cast ultimately in technical terms, why are we asking the churches to initiate the conversation?
I have an answer to that, but I'm curious if anybody else wants to answer.
Kevin wants to. Let Kevin answer.
And then I really do want to hear from others, but I just want to say, some of you might relate. I've heard Brian say before, one of the things he said today, kind of casually just dropping it in, we can change coal into gasoline, we can change natural gas into gasoline, no problem. And I don't know, maybe I'm the only one in the room, but my first reaction when I heard that was, whew, problem solved. We'll dig up the coal, they'll turn it into gasoline, I'll be able to go to the same gas station, put it in the same place in my car, nothing has to change. I think what I hear in myself is a temptation to leave this up to experts, is a temptation to say there are really smart chemists and engineers who are going to fix this for me. I think that's dangerous, first of all, because it's another way of saying them. What are they going to do so that I don't have to change anything? And I also think it's dangerous because, as I said at the beginning, I think if we're a healthy democracy, if we're a healthy society, if we're a healthy set of churches, then we're deciding together how to change. We're not trusting our engineers and our chemists to decide everything about our society. We are certainly engaging our engineers and our chemists in discussion. But they don't set the parameters for discussion. They're not the only ones bringing it. Now, that said, I'm not sure churches need to be the ones starting this conversation. I think this conversation is going on, and churches are all too often not participating in it, except how are we going to pay our heating bill this month? So I guess my best response would be, we want to know how are churches responding to the big questions that are out there.
I think that it's a really good point to ask the question. I think that's really important. And I ask, who were the we that decided petroleum was the best thing to go? It was a very small section of society, probably aimed at capitalism. And so churches, but society as a whole really needs to be a much larger voice. So I think if churches can lead, or lead by example, then I think that's wonderful. But I think we all, as a society, need to be more involved in that conversation.
I think one of the reasons churches need to do it is because churches are one of the few, I would quibble with this term, but let it be for now, one of the few voluntary associations in the United States where we come together regularly with people who are somewhat different than us. Granted, the thing about, 10 o'clock in the morning is the most segregated. 10 o'clock on Sunday morning is the most segregated time. Nonetheless, most often you'll find at least someone in the pew with you that has some different view than you do. So that's one reason why I think it's really important, because none of these things will get solved if we only be birds of a feather who are flocking together. And secondly, because congregations have a responsibility to be, this phrase we used to use a lot, communities of moral deliberation. And that no one person can think about all of these issues, even if we don't aspire to the technical knowledge. that engineers have, we can't think about more than one little thing at a time on our own. So that when we have to make a simple decision at the checkout line or about what car to buy, it's real easy to turn in on ourselves and think, it's only me, it's only my decision, and that turning in on ourselves is precisely, according to Luther, the definition of sin.
Well, you were asking both, you know, the role of science and the role of religion, and I think, you know, as you were saying, that they're intricately connected. Science can help tell us what the options are, what is possible. Religion and morality can help us figure out what we should choose to do, what we could do versus what we should do. And so, you know, the science might tell us that nuclear could be the way to reduce our carbon footprint, but it's our religious communities and our congregations that will help us determine whether that's a good idea or not. So I think that it is really important to include the faith community in those discussions because we are the moral voice. We help look at the ethics of issues and see the big picture and see just because something is possible doesn't mean we should do it.
I think I'd state it slightly differently. I think that normally the greater community, in this case we're talking about churches, but the greater community sets the boundary limits on what's going to be acceptable to the community. And it's the technical and financial communities that actually then choose the specific technology that will be developed for that, because they've got to make the business cases out of it, they've got to do the design work to make it happen. So, if you really want to involve the churches, I think it's going to be more for setting those boundary limits in terms of what's acceptable, in terms of resources, in terms of pollution, in terms of those sorts of things.
That's a great point. I think this is a much bigger problem than a church problem or a science problem. This is really a political problem. It must be addressed at a very, very high level so that we have the correct political people that can drive and set the goal for the whole country, the whole world, and we all have to participate in it, but it has to come at a much, much higher level than a bunch of individual churches.
Absolutely. I mean, I guess the only thing I'd say is I think we get the leaders we demand, and so we're not going to get the leader who's going to come and say, I will lead you to the bright energy future, unless we yell at our leaders until they lead us to the bright energy future. If there is anything. So I think your last point that you need congregations getting people agitated in order to have good leadership is good.
I would first disagree with the idea that the energy choices that have been made as time goes on have been made by a select few people. I mean, the choices are made every time you put gas in your car and decide to drive to the store or choose to put an air conditioner in your house. I mean, it's there are choices that you know, the act of buying something affects the marketplace to the extent that it becomes profitable to do something and then somebody does it. And oil became very profitable to do that for a particular reason. Now there are certain incidents that occur in terms of, you know, who killed the electric car and all that type of stuff about different, you know, ripping street cars out of places to buy motor companies early on to affect how people get around. But we can't really absolve the responsibility for the choices that were made over time just because it seems like this mysterious thing out here that happened. In the end, it's what people buy is what really drives what goes on. And the second point, from the standpoint of the churches, it's nice to talk about, you know, how we will look at these decisions and try to affect the debate on that from a church standpoint. But I think what was said back there is actually more going to be the case in the next few years, and that is how do churches respond to the changing conditions if that does happen. If energy keeps on getting more expensive, the social structures that the churches are very involved in are going to be very affected. If you are, you know, food banks are already having enormous problems both transporting stuff around, but just getting enough food in to feed the growing numbers of people that are having problems. Eating old churches, what happens when people can't really afford the gas to get from their far-flung churches into church
on Sunday or for the committee meeting in the middle of the week, and it's gonna it has the potential for big changes on how churches interact with the rest of society. So I think that's a big part of from the ethical standpoint of how we respond as a church to changes in society and pressures in society to do things in response to crises that could occur because of energy problems.
If we got time for one more question, I have a backup question I'd have.
The question about leaving our environmental stewardship up to technical experts is to me like it's like the question: should we leave protection of rights of individuals, protection of people of different color, of different beliefs, to the lawyers, the experts? Wasn't it the faith movement? Wasn't it Reverend Martin Luther King who really and the people of faith who really changed things in the country? Anyway, I just wanted to say that I believe that if there's any meaning in the conundrum that we're in, it's that we have to grapple with these issues.
Yeah, I think maybe we need like four more days. Yeah. Thank you all very much.